guest tonight is writer and critic Bob Meir, and we're talking about his book, Trouble Boys, The True Story of the Replacements. Bob, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
This is an outstanding, I would actually say monumental music biography. How did you
say that? That's fine.
Now, for the reader, you feel like you're there at every step along the way, including with small concerts, like you mentioned, the one at Exit 13. How did you do the research for this book?
Well, I was fortunate in that I, in addition to having kind of the direct participation of most of the band, I had the participation of their manager, Peter Jesperson, the guy who sort of discovered them and ran Twin Tone Records, the indie label they were on for the first half of their career. And he kept a pretty good archive, certainly of the early years. I mean, by the time they got to the major labels in the mid-80s, things were a little more documented or better documented. But those first few years, you know, if not for Peter's archive, it would have been very hard to kind of, you know, figure out a lot of the stuff and kind of put the story back together. In a way, but fortunately he was a bit of a pack rat and kept a really good paper trail, you know, flyers and documents, road documents, and kind of the history of the band. I think he always had a sense that, you know, someday somebody was going to come along and want to really dig into that stuff. And then, of course, I was very fortunate in that this was the era of kind of tape trading and bootlegging of a sort, you know, at least kind of the community of indie rock fans that were, you know, going to shows. So a good portion of these shows, not all of them certainly, were recorded. So you have not only a kind of paper trail, but also an oral document of that stuff. So it became a little bit easier to kind of, you know, put myself in those moments and reconstruct the story. But, you know, and fortunately there was a good amount of, you know, the Replacements. One of a big part of the story is that they were a, you know, a critics band almost from the beginning, even
right
from before the beginning in a sense. So there was always a good amount of coverage of them. So, you know, whether it was college newspapers or little zines that are long defunct and not catalog, I was able to kind of go back and search out in some cases, or in some cases dig through the archive that I had and kind of and take a bigger picture view of what happened. And I think that allowed me in terms of the narrative of the book to kind of put the reader in that moment or in those moments.
For people who have only known the Replacements by their music, had never seen them perform on stage or knew anything about their life, this book is going to come out, I think, as a bit of a surprise. Because, I mean, you listen to the Replacements music, and it's outstanding. I mean, it's like what I would call now call classic songs, okay? But people who've never seen them on stage several times aren't going to understand what went on stage. And we'll talk about that in a bit. But also, they're really hard life that some of them. And this book opens with the 1995 funeral of Bob Stinson, the so-called lunatic guitarist who didn't OD. His body just gave out. And that sets a tone. That sets a weird tone for your entire book, because there's always going to be this sort of tragic element to the Replacements.
Yeah, and that was a decision I think I had to make in a way. As a writer, you kind of struggle and think, well, you know, with the intro, the opening, how do I start this book? And in a way, even though Bob was kind of out of the band, a certain portion of it, his spirit was really kind of the guiding spirit and the foundational spirit of, and his experience, his life experience. His life led so directly to the formation of the band and to what happened to the band, both good and bad, and how they're seen, that it felt like anything less than starting with that moment. You know, if his passing would have been a compromise, and in a weird way, it was the first and really only reunion of sorts of all the guys who had, you know, were in the band. They got back together this one time, and it was this incredible moment at his funeral, at Bob's funeral. So it felt like anything else that I could have done or flashpoint moment that I could have opened with, and certainly there were many throughout the course of their career that were both insightful and dramatic. It just felt like, given the real history and the story, which, as you point out, most people didn't know, even fans of the band, it felt like it was the only way to start it, you know, really, for me.
Well, for me, it makes their accomplishment that much more incredible. They did it. They, you know, what was it that Tommy said at the very end of the book? However finite and small, we left a mark. And it's really true. I mean, you describe them as four losers who really understood each other. They really did. They got along. There were these four people who had a tough time in life. It's incredible. Bob Stinson's childhood, he was abused sexually, just had a horrific childhood. His brother, Tommy, who's also in the band, was Tommy as affected by that as Bob was?
In a weird way, he was sort of spared the abuse, but I think in sort of being and probably really the only one in his family, in a sense that was spared the abuse. It sort of that impacted, having been spared that, impacted him in a way. And then Bob being sort of sent through and the kind of state system of juvenile jails and reform schools, yep, yep, and group homes, and then him coming back almost as a stranger after a number of years to his little brother Tommy, and then Tommy sort of going down a bad road of delinquency, and Bob seeing that, and in a way the band starts because Bob, having sort of suffered through this kind of experience in the state reform system and through all the stuff he dealt with, wants to save Tommy, and that really is kind of a, you know, in at its heart it's a family story, you know, the story of the Replacements and the story of this book. And so it felt like, you know, for me, that was a tough thing, because you read a lot of, frankly, you read a lot of music bios, and sometimes the early years are the least interesting, the kind of pre-fame years. But in a way, the rooting, the foundation of all the guys in the Replacements is so fundamental to, you know, what the band was, how their career, you know, proceeded, what their music sounded like, and who they were. There was very little separation between that their kind of lives and the life of the band. And so it felt, you know, really important to kind of focus on that. And I think, and I hope, it becomes clear that, you know, there is no separating that. And that's kind of, I think, why people related to the band so viscerally, so, you know, deeply and continue, is that there was no artifice there. It's like, this is a real life experience lived out in these 3-minute songs and in these performances on stage. So I think it really is all one story.
It's fascinating reading about the early years, about their music influences, and the kind of things that they were listening to. Paul Westerberg was listening to things like Slade. He was a huge Slade fan. And they all had their own things that they were listening to. And then sort of the Sex Pistols and the Ramones and the Damned happened. And it really turned them most of them. However, throughout their career, they were bound and determined not to be a hardcore punk band. And as a matter of fact, they did some cool stuff. If the audience was really like a pure punk group, they had some interesting things that they did.
Well, I think, you know, for them, the Replacements was always an attitude, and the idea of the band was a kind of was a kind of freedom. And so anytime there were expectations or regulations or sort of a framework that they had to fit in, they were going to try and bust out of that. And you know, and to their credit, and generally in very amusing ways, whether it would be, you know, playing slowed down Hank Williams covers
so-called pussy set that they would do. They would purposely get underneath the audience's, you know, and it was amazing to watch them do that. They had weird stuff that they would just do on stage.
Yeah, and I think some of that was Paul Westerberg, the kind of front man. I mean, he had a degree of, as they say, oppositional defiance syndrome, where, you know, if you said yes to him, he was going to say no. And you know, the rest of the band, they were adventurers, and they were rebellious, I think, just by their nature. And so they were very happy to kind of, you know, take that path when it was presented to them. So, it's interesting now, so much of their legend is based on things like that, which, you know, probably were, you know, seen as larks or inconsequentials. But as Paul always said, the band, the Replacements as a band, was so much about an attitude. And that's the thing, I think, that lingers with people.
Who were the Impediments?
The Impediments was the short-lived moniker of the Replacements. Basically, you know, the band started with Bob and Tommy Stinson, and eventually Chris Marrs. And there were a number of people sort of in and out of the early version of this group, which was originally called Dog Breath. And then when Paul Westerberg, a kind of high school dropout janitor, was walking by the Stinson's house and heard this, you know, incredible rumbling coming out of the basement, and he snuck in to sort of see what it was, and eventually, through a series of things, ended up in the band. You know, they decided to call themselves the Impediments briefly, and then they got thrown out of one of their first gigs at sober house.
Yeah, don't go fast over that, because that's one of many great stories in this book. So one of their first big concerts is for a totally sober audience. Now, at this point, you would probably describe them as an alcohol-centric band. Dog Breath, as you describe it, was a weed-centric band.
Right.
Impediments is an alcohol-centric band, and they're playing for this, like, 12-stepping, like, group of people.
teens, yeah. And it's interesting, too. It's interesting, you know, a band that became synonymous or certainly very famous for their alcohol use on stage much later, you know, they started out playing in this circuit of kind of sober dances and sober teen sort of environment in Minneapolis and Minnesota at that time, being a very much a kind of a rehab-centered culture, you know, because of the Hazelden Clinic and yep. some of that stuff. And it sort of really trickled down in that era, certainly. So, yeah, there's a great irony that the Replacements really got their name because they were replacing themselves because they had played the show as the Impediments and were thrown out by the Sober House director and said, he said, you know, you'll never work in this town again. So very quickly they decided they needed to change their name and thus came up with the Replacements.
You listen to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is writer and critic Bob Mayer. And we're talking about his book. Man, it is a great read. Trouble Boys, The True Story of the Replacements. One of the things that was really interesting for me to read, mainly because I only knew small things about it, was the entire scene, I hate to use that word, that was happening mm-hmm. in Minneapolis and in the area around that at that time. Let's talk about Peter Jaspersen and who he was. Mm-hmm. And I don't even know if I can pronounce this, the Oak Folk Jokopus.
Peter was a kind of, in a sense, a kind of Renaissance figure in the then burgeoning kind of new wave scene. He was essentially a record store clerk and manager who worked at Orfolk, as it was called, and which was really considered one of the great and preeminent record stores in the Midwest at that time. I mean, they were the kind of store that was into bands like Big Star before anybody, you know, decades before anybody knew who they were. They would get imports of all the punk singles. It was a kind of, and at that time, Minneapolis was very much centered around record stores. The scene by the sort of 70s, after a kind of 60s garage rock and label heyday, had kind of become really the province of cover bands and a very straight-laced kind of radio programming atmosphere. So where there was kind of progressive music and ideas about music happening was in record stores, and that's where Peter was sort of situated. And as a result of that, he and a partner, Paul Stark, and another partner, Charlie Holman, started a label really to address the need that was at Minneapolis at the time, because there was this, you know, punk and new wave kind of movement locally that was brewing, and so they decided to start putting those records out. And he also helped book the Longhorn, which was one of the first clubs at that time to really bring in, you know, bands like Elvis Costello and Blondie and things like that. So he was kind of at the center of a lot of things for a couple years, but was really looking for this band. And Peter was a big believer in music, and you know, it was for him, music was his religion, and he was really waiting, I think, in a sense, for the thing that was going to be that he could go all in on. And through in a very unlikely way, the Replacements turned out to be that band, and he became, you know, kind of their instant label head and eventually manager and supporter. And really, I think he is, and I emphasize him in the book a good amount, a really pivotal figure.
Oh yeah.
For a lot of reasons, mainly because, you know, with the Replacements, the baseline of functionality was pretty low, as Westerberg puts it. You know, none of them had a high school diploma or a driver's license. So for a start, it was very hard to even get to the gigs if somebody hadn't sort of come in and been that guardian angel early on for them. And Jaspersen certainly filled that role and in a way helped evolve them musically, because, you know, for a lot of them, they didn't, you know, these were young guys. They didn't have a lot of money. And so their exposure to music sort of increased tenfold with people. Peter, who had, you know, the incredible record collection and access to all this music. So I think, you know, more so than most managers, more so than most kind of early supporters, he became a pivotal figure and a big part of their story, and a big reason why they were able to survive and last as long as they did to make it to the major label world and to a bigger audience.
This book really comes alive when they're on stage, because you do an incredible job of describing them not only on stage but traveling in the back of the van there,
right,
and their whole life. I love the way that they didn't look like any other band at that time. Mm-hmm. They looked like they had just come off of work.
Right.
And that actually, for me, really captured a lot about the appearance of what the early Replacements were like. They were all rough edges and struggle. That's a quote from your from your book, and it was an amazing thing to see on stage. They had interesting relations with other bands too. What was their relationship with Husker Du?
Well, Husker Du were sort of contemporaries in a sense in Minneapolis. Husker Du started maybe about 6-7 months before the Replacements had, and musically they were, you know, Husker Du was a little bit faster, especially at that early time, a little bit more of a hardcore and more in line with kind of what was going on. But they were friends and friendly rivals. Husker Du certainly took them on the road early on and exposed them to, you know, audiences in Chicago and places like that. And I think where they started to diverge in a sense, the Replacements by their sort of second or third album, Hootenanny, they were becoming, in part, you know, the reason the Replacements became the Replacements, which is a kind of a point I think that happened with their third album, Hootenanny, where they were trying all kinds of different styles, all different kinds of music, so without any kind of adherence to sort of, rigid genre definitions, was partly because they were playing with Husker Du and playing with hardcore audiences, and they were resisting that sort of that box and being put in that box. And so their music, just out of boredom, out of sheer rebelliousness, started to explore all this stuff. So Husker Du, like, you know, figures pretty prominently. And Minneapolis as a place, there was other bands that sort of figure in the Replacements' early history, the Suburbs, who were a big, you know, were the preeminent band in Minneapolis at the time. You know, I think the Replacements and Minneapolis in general, there, it was a very small and close-knit community at that time, even though there was a tremendous amount of creativity going on, not just on the sort of indie punk and new wave level, but certainly Prince was happening also at the same time, and his whole world. So I think Minneapolis in general, but at that time creatively, musically, was just exploding, and the Replacements were part of that, even though they were sort of a little bit outside of it. They never allowed themselves to be, just by dint of their personalities, to be, you know, part of a community as such, but they certainly were, you know, connected with the Suburbs and Husker Du and bands like that, and I think those relationships in a way defined their career too, to a certain extent, either by, you know, reacting against it or choosing their own path again.
Talk about Paul Westerberg writing songs. There's a great quote where somebody wrote that he wrote more songs than more often than people went to the bathroom.
Right.
He's prolific. I mean, it was amazing how much stuff he wrote.
I think he was just somebody who was incredibly creative and was waiting for the right outlet, the right vehicle for his creativity before he joined the Replacements. He was really mainly a lead guitar player, and that's what he had spent, you know, 4 or 5 years kicking around various kind of suburban bands, basement bands, and, you know, bands that really weren't doing much or making it. But he was kind of learning his craft in a sense, or the creativity was kind of bubbling within him. And then when he found the Stinson Brothers and Chris Mars, I think, as he puts it in a book, their energy was something he felt he could harness, and just even playing with them the first few times, he began to write songs, and then, you know, then the sort of floodgates opened up after that. And I think, you know, very quickly he evolved maybe past the initial point of their first two records, which were, you know, more in the hardcore punk vein,
right.
And that's where you get the real blossoming with Hootenanny and Let It Be and Into Tim, and, you know, and so I think, again, all of them to a man, but Westerberg especially, were reactive kind of personalities. They reacted and responded personally, creatively, to whatever they were faced with or whoever they were with. And in his case, I think, you know, that the relationship with the band and with the Stinson Brothers and Chris Mars was kind of the thing that sparked and shaped his creativity moving forward.
Talk about Bob's outfits on stage, because that was, as you'd mentioned, is key to the Replacement spectacle.
Well, the Replacements, like, you know, like a lot of bands, they evolved, and they evolved quickly. You know, the first few years, I think they were, you know, like a lot of bands, you're struggling, you just want to play it and play it right, or you're figuring things out. And I think, they were easily a bunch that was easily bored, you know, whether it was with the hardcore scene or with a certain kind of playing a certain kind of music. And after a while, I think, you know, sort of just dressing down and dressing normally got to be boring for them as well. And each of them sort of went through their phases. Tommy being the sort of sharpest looking one, he was more in the kind of, you know, Billy Idol new wave mold, you know, looking. And then Paul would don eye mascara occasionally, but it was really Bob who outdid them all, because he was it started really as Bob's band. And of course, you know, when you get a songwriter as estimable as Westerberg in the mix, you know, a lot of the attention goes to him. And I think, in a way, dressing up and dressing down, or dressing not dressing at all in Bob's case, as was sometimes you know, going on stage even naked, was a kind of way to wrest some control and attention back to him. But, you know, it all kind of flowed from his personality, which was out there, and his guitar playing. It was all kind of, again, part of the same package.
But who was Pappy the Clown?
Oh, well, that was Chris Marr's sort of alter ego that would sort of creep out everyone.
It sounded a lot creepier than what Bob was doing. It sounded right. Reading about it in the book, it sounded a lot weirder. You know, Bob was doing all this stuff, but you expected that from Bob. But then this Pappy the Clown thing started happening, and it just sounded weird.
Well, Chris Marr was a budding artist, and now he's actually a very, very successful contemporary artist. And his work really is, striking and inventive, and sort of has elements of the Hieronymus Bosch and the circus and all these kind of weird ideas. So I think, you know, this was, within the band, everybody found the outlets to express themselves. If it wasn't just playing and songwriting, sometimes it would be, stage antics or persona. In Chris's case, it was dressing up like this sort of mute clown and sort of scaring everyone. So I think, you know, that as you're on the road a lot and, you know, you're in a band for 10 or 11 years, I think you see a lot of sides of people's personalities. They come out in ways that maybe you don't often expect. And sometimes it's in how you play, and sometimes it's how you act and dress, and sometimes it's throwing on the clown makeup.
One of the things that was amazing to me is how young Tommy was in the beginning parts of this band. People don't realize that, I think.
Right, yeah, he was 7 years younger than Bob, so when Bob and Paul were, 1920, Tommy was 13, 14 years old, he basically, the Replacements, the first few years of their career, they didn't travel outside of, long weekends and really through the upper Midwest. They only began touring in the spring of 83, really after Tommy quit 10th grade. So, it was a functional, thing, too, in a way for him to stay in the band and for the band to be able to kind of go out and explore the world. He had to quit school, but as he puts it, he had no reservations about that. He was ready to kind of go on his rock and roll adventure. But yeah, it's I suppose now it at the time, I think, the musicians were a lot younger. Punk rock bands were in their teens and 20s. It wasn't so strange. But I think now the idea of a 14-year-old, 15-year-old, even 16-year-old kid going out on the road and playing rock clubs would just, it seems much stranger now than it probably did then, even though it was still a kind of anomaly at that time.
There's a great section where you talk about what it was like to be in the van while they were traveling from place to place, especially when the Bad Brains came on. Basically, it turned into a mobile mosh pit.
Mobile mosh pit. Yeah, I mean, I think when you that was part of the fun of doing the book, was kind of exploring these little things. You know, what is life on the road like with the Replacements circa 1984? and as Tommy put it, when they got in that van, beat up van, it was both their sanctuary and their jail cell. You know, you're on the road for hours and hours and days and weeks and months out of the year, and so it you were kind of trapped there, and you had to entertain yourself any way you could think of. And I think, a lot of rambunctious youthful spirit and beers will do that. You'll have your own mobile mosh pit.
We're going to run out of time, but I want you to talk about the Saturday Night Live performance in detail. That's like a classic Replacement story.
Yeah, they ended up, it was at the time they just released their first major label album, Tim, and they were kind of maintaining at that point their policy of not wanting to do music videos, because I think Westerberg was sort of against the idea of crafting an image for the band or for the song. You know, at that time that was the zenith of high dollar, big price, lip syncing kind of music videos, and I think they were uncomfortable with that, and I think they were frankly uncomfortable with sort of seeing themselves, in that light. So the record company was trying to figure out ways to sort of expose them to the public, and obviously Warner Brothers, their label at the time, had a good relationship with Saturday Night Live historically and got them on there. Unfortunately, fortunately, it was at the time it was a sort of considered a disastrous appearance because they were so unlike anything that was on your musical kind of TV at that time. I mean, you're talking about the era of Solid Gold and synthesizer bands, and here's this incredibly loud, unkempt rock band just coming through the screen on Saturday Night Live. And, they raised some hackles at Saturday Night Live, upset Lorne Michaels because Paul sort of cursed off mic at Bob, and then they changed clothes in the interim. And, at the time it was seen as they had, gone a little too far. But of course, it becomes, again, part of their legend. It's the, TV appearance that was one of their only two real national TV appearances. But, it's like I say, it's taken on this mythic proportion. musicians, and, well, it was ultimately good for their reputation, even though at the time it was sort of seen as a misstep. But I think that's the Replacement story kind of in a nutshell, the things that were seen as at the time as kind of commercial missteps or behavioral things that were going to keep them from attaining this much desired commercial hit status at the time. You know, in the long run, those things are passed down generation to generation, these moments, whether it's playing on Saturday Night Live or Bob in His Dress or, you know, the rebellious things that they did. And so I think in a way, even though the short-term success wasn't there, the reputation and the myth and the legacy and the romance of the band built. And, you know, that's why when they reunited in 2013 to 2015, you know, they could go and fill a baseball stadium and play at the Flushing Meadows or at the, you know, Forest Hills in New York. And so it was like, it's the seed that sort of sprung a great tree after 30 years.
I was incredibly disappointed that they were not inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame because I think they deserve it.
Yeah, they were nominated about right around then.
Yeah, I can remember that.
And got close, I think, just in terms of, you know, there was a kind of swell at that time. But, you know, it's perfect that they didn't get in. Probably won't, because it's, again, it's another thing that keeps them kind of pure, keeps that outsider status, I suppose, as part of their legend.
But they deserve it. All you have to do is listen to the music.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, my one hope for the book is, and I think you said it at the top, is when you know the story,
it becomes much more. It's a poignant. And this is a cinematic story. I'm going to be surprised if this is not picked up for a film treatment.
Right. Well, you know, and like I say, it's just, for me, the thing that I hope people take away from it is that they appreciate the music that much more. You know, when you kind of know the story and know the struggle, it's like, wow, it's like, it's amazing they lasted as long as they did, and B, made as many great records, you know, 8 albums in 12 years or whatever, or 10 years, and the music still stands up.
It does.
And there's a diversity in that music, you know, from the first hardcore punk record to the indie rock stuff to really, you know, by the end, they're making pop records and singer-songwriter type records, and they're all good, and you can sort of access them at any point along the way. So
you've been listening to my guest tonight, writer and critic Bob Mayer. We've been talking about his book. It is a great read, Trouble Boys, The True Story of the Replacements. Bob, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
You're listening to WISN 9.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.
Just